anyway, but that she was going to Henry Thorne for help, Emmy's father. And she didn't even tell her. How long were they? But Emmy couldn't find the words to phrase so delicate and private a question. Mr. Bowker gave a mirthless chuckle. You really don't know, do you? Emmy shook her head. On and off since the day you were born. Your mother was a 16-year-old maid in your father's house. He was twice her age, and unhappily married. When she ended up pregnant, he put her up in a flat across the river, paid for the doctor, the hospital, paid for your nappies, and your blankets, and your sitters, found her new jobs when she needed them, and got her out of jams when she got herself in them. The air in the room felt warm with his indignation. Or maybe it was just hers. Because he had to hide what he'd done to stay out of jail and keep his fortune and reputation, Emmy said hotly. Because he thought he loved her. Emmy was stunned into silence. Before she could summon words to ask him what he meant by that, the door opened, and an older man in a black suit and cap stepped inside. "I'm here for Miss Emmeline Downtree," he said. Mr. Bowker nodded to the world that waited outside the open door. "Watch your step, Miss Downtree." And then he pivoted to return to his office. Emmy walked numbly to the sleek black car waiting curbside. The driver helped her inside, but Emmy would later not remember whether he said anything to her, nor which streets they drove down, before he turned into the curved driveway of a stately home that was as large as the entire row of flats in Whitechapel. The grey-stoned mansion was 4 stories high, trimmed in white. Miniature topiaries lined the walkway to the massive front door. The driver parked the car and then came around to Emmy's side to assist her out. He motioned toward the wide steps that led to the entrance. The front door swung open, and a maid in a navy blue dress and white lace apron appeared on the threshold.
"If you will follow me, please," she said.
Emmy took the steps slowly and then entered a marble-tiled foyer. Gilded mirrors and picture frames hung on walls that seemed endless. The maid showed her into a room that appeared to be a study or library. Books lined the walls. Leather sofas and chairs were set about in cozy groupings. A fire danced in the grate, and wherever there weren't books or leather, there was gleaming mahogany. Above the fireplace was a portrait of a man who seemed vaguely familiar to her, seated next to a slightly plump woman who stood next to him with her arm around his shoulder. On his other side was a boy, about 12. With his forearm draped over the back of his father's chair. The man in the portrait looked like Emmy. Or rather, she looked like him. Henry Thorne. Her father. For several long moments, Emmy just stood there and stared at the man who had fathered her. She didn't hear footfalls from behind. There was just suddenly a voice.
"Miss Downtree."
Emmy startled, and turned to see the woman in the portrait, older now. "Yes," she answered.
"Agnes Thorne, won't you sit down?"
The woman's tone was cool, as though her words had been carved of ice. Emmy took the chair Agnes Thorne offered her, and the woman sat down opposite, smoothing her wool skirt. Her brown hair held tints of grey, but her complexion was flawless. Her lips full and red, and the pearls at her neck and ears luminescent. She was not beautiful, but she had a commanding air, a gracefulness born of a lifetime of privilege. Emmy caught a whiff of the woman's perfume. It smelled like something from another world altogether. The world of the wealthy. A tea tray was set between them. Agnes lifted the pot.
"Tea?"
"Yes, thank you." The woman poured and then handed Emmy a cup without so much as a tremble in her fingers.
"I wanted to be clear between us
that the check you are given is the end of the road. She spooned sugar, something Emmy hadn't seen in months and months, into her cup and stirred. There will be no more after this. Pardon? Agnes laid the spoon carefully on the saucer that held her cup. Your connection to this family, however small it may be, is done after this. We will not hear from you again. Is that understood? Blood rushed to Emmy's cheeks as humiliation bloomed inside her. She fought to stay in control and not let this woman see her shame. Emmy needed answers. She deserved answers.
No, it's not understood, actually. I have a few questions.
The woman looked up, surprised, and instantly furious.
You are not in a position to ask questions, Miss Downtree. You have my husband's money. I suggest you take it and leave.
Why did it take 4.5 years for me to learn that my father is dead? Emmy asked. Agnes sniffed, put her cup down, and stood.
I thought we could have a civilized conversation regarding this, but I see now that we cannot. You will not get another shilling from me. Not a one.
Emmy was not leaving. Not yet. She stayed seated.
I don't want anything of yours. You can be sure of that. I just want a few answers. Why did it take 4.5 years for me to learn that my father is dead?
The woman sat back down slowly.
It's wartime. Very hard to locate people. You are no longer living at your last known address. We couldn't find you.
She was being untruthful. Emmy felt sure of it. You didn't try to find me, did you? Agnes Thorne crossed one leg over the other.
Be careful whom you accuse of lying, Miss Downtree.
Emmy saw hurt in the woman's eyes when she said this, and it occurred to Emmy that this woman had been lied to for years. Henry Thorne had carried on his affair with Mum up until the day they both died. And this woman had never known. Emmy felt a strange and instant kinship with Agnes Thorne. Emmy had been lied to as well, about the very same thing.
I didn't know who he was,
Emmy said, her heart aching for the two of them in a way that astounded her.
Mum never said a word. I didn't even know she was still seeing him.
Don't you dare say a word about it,
Agnes said, enunciating the first three words as if they were arrows.
Not a word.
But I didn't. I knew nothing. The woman's chest was heaving as she locked her gaze on Emmy, her eyes wild with anger.
How could you not know? Do you think I am silly enough to believe you didn't know where your clothes came from, and your food, and the rent for your flat, and every toy you got for Christmas? I've seen the hidden ledgers, Miss Downtree. I know exactly how much money he wasted on you and your whore of a mother all those years. He paid for it all. So don't tell me you didn't know.
Emmy's mouth was open, but no sound came out. She had no words to sling back in retaliation. She felt as though she had been tarred and feathered, right there in that beautiful room, with its expensive furnishings. The whore's daughter. Agnes Thorne could see that she had Emmy now, defenseless, in her grip. She leaned forward.
I don't know how you found out about the will, but I am telling you, I am finished with you. You go to the press with this, and I will spend every penny I have making your life as miserable as you've made mine.
I didn't. I never. I was sent a letter informing me that I had money coming to me.
Emmy finally sputtered.
Liar. I swear it's true. You lie. I didn't even know his name until I got this letter. I didn't know anything.
Agnes Thorne was at the ready to denounce Emmy, when a voice broke through the heated exchange.
She's telling the truth, Mother.
Emmy turned toward the sound of the voice. A young man, perhaps a little younger than she was, stood in the doorway.
He was the boy in the portrait, grown up.
Colin!
Agnes sputtered.
What did you do?
The man came into the room. Emmy could see that he favored his mother in looks. But his eyes were not full of hatred and disgust. I did what I told you I was going to do when I turned 18. I told Mr. Bowker to find her. That money is hers. Dad left it to her. Agnes seemed to deflate before Emmy. Where a minute earlier there had been a fiery warrior, now there was a beggar woman. The change in her was that remarkable.
Colin, how could you do such a thing?
Emmy could feel the pain behind her words, the sense of betrayal. Because it was the right thing to do. You know it is. The man turned to Emmy and put out his hand. She shook it slowly, and with little enthusiasm. She was still so astonished. I'm Colin Thorne, your half-brother. Agnes winced and turned her face away, as though she could no longer bear the sight of Emmy in her house. Emmy looked from one to the other. From the half-brother she didn't know she had, who'd risked his mother's wrath to see that she was paid in full, to the wronged woman, who'd learned too late that her husband had been unfaithful to her. And then there was Emmy in the middle, the whore's daughter, the ignorant child who couldn't see where the good things her mother had had came from, or rather, who chose not to. Emmeline, the girl she used to be. She reached into her handbag and closed her fingers around the check that had been made out to Emmeline Downtree. She pulled it out, laid it on the table by her teacup, and stood. She started to walk away from the man who wanted her compensated and the woman who wished she had never been born. It was several seconds before either one of them realized Emmy was leaving them and their money. Colin came after her.
Wait, Miss Downtree, wait!
But Emmy did not wait.
Miss Downtree!
Her hand was at the door when Colin reached her. He had the envelope in his hand.
It's yours. He wanted you to have it.
Emmy looked at the envelope. Such a thin little thing to have caused such grief today.
But that's not what I wanted, she said.
And she left him standing there, with the envelope in his hand, his fingers covering the word Emmeline, scrawled across the front in Mr. Bowker's practiced script. Chapter 32. Outside the Thorne mansion, the driver stood next to the vehicle, as if he'd been told Emmy would only be a short while. He snapped to action when Emmy emerged from the house and opened the car door for her. Emmy would have walked away from that place on her own two legs, but she had no idea where she was. She got inside.
Paddington, miss?
The driver said when he was also back inside the vehicle. Emmy did not want to go back to Thistle House right then. Not as Emmeline. And that was who she firmly was, as she stepped out of the Thorne home slathered in recriminations. She wanted more than anything to go to Primrose, and fall asleep on the heap of bridal gowns, and never open her eyes again. She wanted to wake up in the arms of the angels, and have them tell her she was worthy of love. To give it, and to have it given to her. But there was no place like that in London. Not for her. Except, perhaps. The Savoy, she said. 30 minutes later, Emmy was inside the lobby of the hotel, where she used to go every Monday on her campaign to find London's orphans. Mac wasn't there. It was only mid-afternoon. He was, no doubt, in the underground studio at Broadcasting House, working dials and switches, as someone leaned over a microphone and described the advance of the Allies across Germany. She settled into a chair to wait for him. Emmy was not aware she had fallen asleep until Mac was bending over her, gently shaking her awake and murmuring her name. When Emmy opened her eyes, she saw a woman standing behind Mac, her hand on his arm, and the utter despair of that singular moment was nearly the end of her. But then the woman walked away, clearly having spied the party she was looking for. Mac was now alone.
"Is it really you?" Emmy said.
He laughed. "I was about to ask you the same thing. What are you doing here?" Emmy stood and threw her arms around his neck and held him tight. It took him a moment to respond in kind, but then his arms were around her as well. She did not want to start crying into his shirt collar, but she did. And once the seal was broken, the tears would not stop coming. Mac cupped the back of her head in his hand and drew her closer.
"Isabel, is it about Julia?"
She shook her head. Emmy wanted to tell him why she was suddenly at the Savoy, in tears, and wrapped in his embrace. But to repeat every ugly thing Agnes Thorne had said to her, and about her, and relive it, held no appeal. Besides, that was Emmeline's story, not Isabel's.
"I just had a really terrible day. Awful."
Emmy pulled away, and he immediately handed her a handkerchief.
"I don't want to talk about it."
"You're in London," he said, and it was a question that wasn't a question.
"There was someone I needed to see. It couldn't be helped."
He studied her. "And it didn't go well?"
"No, it didn't."
"Sure you don't want to talk about it?" he said.
"Quite sure."
"Can I take you to dinner, then?"
"Will your girlfriend mind?"
Emmy said, handing him his handkerchief and making no attempt to hide her disdain. He laughed. "She's just a friend who's a girl, Isabel."
"Will there be a stiff drink?"
Emmy wanted to drown the word whore, 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 which kept echoing like a clanging bell in her head. Drown it in drink.
Sure.
Mac gave her his arm, and they started to walk toward the lobby doors.
"You look beautiful when you cry, by the way," he said.
Emmy leaned into him as they stepped into the early evening. Surely there would be no air raids tonight. Germany had nothing left to send up into the air.
"I don't like it when I cry," she said. "Makes me feel weak."
He slid his arm around her waist and kissed her temple. "Oh, but it's our tears that make us human, Isabel." Being on Mac's arm as they walked, and in his arms as they danced after dinner, and then as they walked past the ruins along the river, Emmy felt something being returned to her after a long absence. The fires had stopped burning. The bombs had stopped falling. The debris was being cleared away. The slabs where buildings once stood were being scraped clean to begin their second life, a life after the war. It was not far off, this new life. A few months, maybe by the end of the year, but she could feel that the turning of the tide was just beyond the horizon. She was ready to feel again. To feel something good. Chocolate on her tongue. New shoes on her feet. Holidays at the seaside. Blank canvases on which to paint. Kisses on her neck and lips. They went back to the Savoy to see whether Emmy could get a room, as she had missed the last train to Oxford, but the hotel was full.
"Come up to my room, Isabel," Mac offered.
"I can sleep on the floor. Scout's honor." And that was the plan. Mac would have honored it. Emmy was sure of that. But sometime in the night, she dreamed that she was the one trapped in the basement of the Sharrington Crescent Hotel, buried in rubble, and no one would help her. She was suffocating, and darkness was closing in on her. She would be buried alive. Worse. Julia was in the rubble with her, and her eyes were open, glassy, and unblinking, like the dead man on the street during the Blitz, whose nose and mouth were spattered with blood. Her screams woke Mac, who was at her side in an instant, shushing her, calming her, and then kissing her. Everywhere. When he realized what was happening, he pulled away, an apology on his lips. But she drew him back to his bed. Emmy wanted to be with him. She wanted to feel as if she mattered. As Mac entwined his body with hers, as close as two people could possibly be, Emmy suddenly understood why Mum had kept going back to Henry Thorne, even though he was married to someone else. It wasn't just about the money he gave her to survive as a single mother. He made her feel wanted, desired, precious. Mum had made an exchange, just like everyone does when quaking under a load that seems far too heavy. She exchanged a transparent life of abject poverty for one of secrets and illusion that kept her and her daughters fed and clothed. Julia had likewise exchanged the bride's box for the fairy tale book when she didn't want Emmy to leave. Emmy had exchanged Julia for her own aspirations when she didn't want anyone else telling her what she could and couldn't do. And that very day, Emmy had exchanged the absolution her father had willed to her for her own dignity. This was how people balanced the scales their world was tipping, Emmy reasoned. It was only after time had passed that a person was able to see whether she might have been able to bear the load she was sure had been too heavy. But life is lived at the moment you are living it, she thought. No one but God in heaven has the benefit of seeing beyond today. In the morning when she awoke, Mac smiled at her in sleepy wakefulness and fingered a lock of her hair away from her eyes. Good morning, he said. Emmy was afraid to rise from where she lay. Time seemed to have stilled, and she didn't want it to go about its relentless forward march. She didn't know which girl she would be as she rose from the bed. She whispered her reluctance to leave. Stay then. I can't. You know I can't. Then marry me. He said it so swiftly. Emmy waited for him to laugh and assure her he was joking. Surely he was joking. But the seconds flitted by, and he did not laugh. I'm crazy about you. Marry me, Isabel. Emmy stared at him open-mouthed, not daring to imagine herself the happy wife of a good man. She was no friend of happiness. Mac had no idea whom he was proposing to. I'm not who you think I am, Emmy whispered, tears gathered at the corners of her eyes. He kissed them away. You're the woman I love. But you will leave when the war is over. Everyone has to leave sometime, Isabel. Life is about coming and going. Come to America with me. I promise I will live every day to see that you don't regret it. She closed her eyes to stop picturing herself pushing away from England, the only home she had ever known. Pushing away from Julia, finally and fully. Isabel? I don't know what to do. Do you love me? The moment the question was posed, she knew that she did. She did love him. But just because she loved him did not mean she was entitled to happiness with him. Nor did it mean she had the courage to leave England and walk out on a promise she'd made to Mum years before on a sunny beach. What does it matter if I do? Emmy said, rising from the bed and reaching for her clothes. Loving Mac changed nothing about who she was and what she had done. Isabel, she turned to him. Please don't let the unhappiness you knew in the past keep you from accepting happiness now, he said. Please don't. The pulling and twisting of her two identities, Emmeline's past, Isabel's future, was making her head spin. I have to get back. Charlotte will be worried. Isabel? I can't think about the future right now, Mac. Please don't ask me to. He said no more about it. He said hardly anything as he walked her to the train station. Emmy returned to Thistle House and made her apologies for having stayed overnight without letting Charlotte know. Then she told Charlotte what had happened at the lawyer's office, and at the Thorne mansion. She didn't tell Charlotte she'd slept with Mac. But Emmy thought Charlotte knew anyway. Mac rang her twice in the weeks that followed, and Emmy kept the call short, something she had not done before, not when it came to Mac. But his unanswered proposal hung between them like a gift she was too afraid to reach out and take. Her heart ached for Mac, but sleeping with him had been reckless and selfish. And not without consequence. 7 weeks after returning from London, it was clear to Emmy that she was pregnant. As Emmy vomited again and again into the toilet, and as Charlotte placed a cool cloth across the back of her neck, a terrible longing filled the emptiness that gripped her stomach. She missed her mother.
"I want my mom,"
Emmy rasped to Charlotte between heaves. Charlotte leaned over her and kissed the back of Emmy's head. "I know you do." Through all the years of the war, Emmy had awakened each day as Isabel Crofton, but she was still Annie Downtree's daughter. Mum had stood where she was now, alone, pregnant, and reeling from choices made in weakness. Mum alone knew where to find the strength to keep putting one foot in front of the other, despite the stares, the empty days, and the lonely nights. Mum knew how to survive in a world without dreams.
"I don't know how to do this,"
Emmy finally whispered. Charlotte sought Emmy's gaze, maneuvering her face close to Emmy's.
"Tell Mac. He loves you. I've known it all along, and I think you love him too. This child is as much his as it is yours."
Emmy blinked back threatening tears.
"But Mac is American. When the war is over, he will go back to America."
Charlotte looked down and nodded.
"I know. You want me to go? Leave here?"
Emmy could hardly form the words. Thistle House had been her refuge, a sanctuary after the war had taken everything from her.
"We're not talking about what I want."
Charlotte reached for Emmy's hand.
"This is about your life, not mine. You need to make your way back into the world, Isabel. You've a place in it. You need to find what it is. I know you've said you won't ever sketch another bridal gown, and maybe you won't. But you were meant to do something with your life.
I can't believe it's to sit in Thistle House and watch time pass you by."
"But I feel safe here,"
Emmy said, scarcely breathing.
"Safe is not the same as happy. Trust me on this, Isabel."
They were quiet for a moment.
"I won't know what to do with myself in America,"
Emmy finally said. Charlotte smiled.
"You will build a life with a man you love and the child you created. You'll figure out the rest. That's what we all have to do."
Another stretch of silence passed, as Emmy contemplated a future with the only man she could ever see herself loving. It seemed too grand a thing to imagine. It had been too grand for Mum.
Mum.
If she did this, this was where Annie Downtree's daughter and Eloise Crofton's would part, for good. This was where Emmeline Downtree would fade at last into nothing, just like Julia had, like Mum had. Charlotte got to her knees and told Emmy she was going to make some chamomile tea to settle Emmy's stomach.
"You might consider telling Mac who you really are."
"I don't think it will matter to him," Charlotte said as she stood at the doorway. Emmy murmured that if it didn't matter to him, then there was no reason to tell him. Because it mattered to her. Life was about coming and going. For Emmy, it was time to go. Isabel Crofton married Jonah McFarland in a London courthouse on May 8th, the day the Allies declared victory in Europe. The end of hostilities. The newlyweds left for America with Isabel's brand new passport on a foggy morning in July, after a tearful long weekend at Thistle House, where she said her farewells. The morning of their departure, Isabel found herself as she had been the day she left London after Mac had saved her life, desperate to be far from it. She felt the stitching of any last ties to her old life break away as London fell behind her. In her suitcase in the belly of the ship, she carried a small stack of maternity clothes, her watercolor brushes, her birth certificate, a felt box of trinkets, a book of fairy tales, and a hammer. She would not see England again. The hammer would remind her, lest she forget, that she had made a transaction when she became Isabel. Leaving England forever meant she could leave Emmeline Downtree and her terrible sorrows there with it. It seemed a reasonable exchange. Chapter 33. Kendra. I look at the woman across from me on the sofa, framed by her iconic Umbrella Girls paintings behind her. Her hands are crossed in her lap, and she is staring at them. She is Emmeline Downtree. She is Isabel MacFarlane. But you did come back to England, I say. This is Thistle House, isn't it? She nods once.
It is.
What made you return? Isabel raises her head, but turns to gaze out the window.
Oh, I suppose the mighty hand of God. That's what it usually takes to move someone who is holding on to what doesn't belong to her.
She laughs lightly, as though the details of her return still surprise her.
I'm not sure I follow you.
Isabel tips her head to glance at me, but only barely.
You haven't made the mistakes I have, nor have you been flung into a tempest that forces you to make choices you are not prepared to make. I know that. But I hope someday you will remember I told you that you do not own your sins.
I am still at a loss. You're not saying people aren't responsible for the wrong they do, I say, though I can't believe this is what she means. Not after all that she has told me. She sighs gently, wondering perhaps how to make it clear to me. She is revealing something to me, I think. Her purpose for having allowed me to interview her, perhaps?
I am saying, when you make a choice, even if it's a bad one, you've played your hand. You cannot live your life as though you still held all your cards.
Is that why you agreed to let me talk to you today? To tell me this? Isabel laughs.
Good Lord, no. My reason is far more selfish than that.
She smiles at thoughts I am not able to guess at. She shakes her head.
Far more selfish.
I wait for her to continue. She looks at me.
You might have guessed I have not been very adept at being transparent with people. I agree to let you interview me because I plan to leave my history with you.
Me? Isabel crooks an eyebrow.
Yes, of course you. Why not you? You are a history major. This is history. My history. And only a handful of people know it.
You never told anyone who you are? She lifts the corners of her mouth in a half grin.
I told a few. Gwen knows. And Beryl.
Gwen?
My daughter. Mine and Max. We only had the one.
I hear children outside the door in the staircase. Isabel hears them too, and turns to the sound of innocence. Did you ever tell your husband? I ask. She faces me again.
Eventually. Took me 20 years, but I finally told him.
When you came back to England? I had done my research. I knew the artist Isabel MacFarlane had returned to England for a visit in 1958 with her daughter and stayed. Her husband joined her several months later.
"Yes," she says, drawing out the word and giving it an emphasis I don't understand. "When I came back to England."
Isabel reaches for the cloth-bound bundle that she came into the room with a couple of hours earlier.
"Mac and I started out very happy," she says as she unties the ribbon on the bundle. "At least, as happy as two people who have survived the horrors of war can be. We bought a little house in St. Paul, Minnesota, and lived near his parents for the first few years. They were very sweet to me and utterly devoted to Gwen. They were far better at being grandparents than I was at being a mother. I worried all the time about her safety. I was sure that I would lose her just like I lost Julia. Mac wanted to make it in broadcasting, but for whatever reason he didn't. He started writing children's books instead. Mysteries with a teenaged aspiring journalist and his artsy next-door neighbor as the hero and heroine, Joey and Izzy.
You and Mac, I say, proud of myself for figuring this out.
Naturally.
She unfolds the fabric. Inside the bundle are a yellowed envelope and a leather-bound notebook, tawny with age.
"The books did well enough for us to live off that income alone," she continues. "I had my little studio, and I started painting the Umbrella Girls. At first they were just for me. I found that remembering Julia, in this secret way, assuaged the guilt I still felt. I missed this house, and I miss Charlotte and Rose, but I could not bring myself to visit them, not even when Mac's books did well enough that I could have. And then, one day in April 1958, I got a letter."
Isabel hands me the envelope. There is no name on the outside. Opening it carefully, I withdraw three sheets of lavender-hued paper. I read it aloud.
October 12, 1957. "My dear Emmy, if you are reading this letter, then you will know that I have passed on from this life, and that I've left you Thistle House in my will. I have always known I would leave it to you, from the moment you returned to me 17 years ago, after having lost so much. I knew that very day that you and I were bound together, as surely and as irrevocably as those who share the same name, the same blood. You were as much my daughter as any child that could have been born from my body. It has not mattered to me that after you left England to begin your new life, you felt it necessary to keep me at a distance, not just physically, but within our souls. I know how precarious it can be to live the reinvented life. Your birthday cards and Christmas gifts to me over the years, while they may have seemed small and insignificant to you, have meant the world to me, especially after the passing of Rose. I wrote to you only as often as you wrote to me, because I wished nothing to upset the careful balance you had struck with what was, what is, and what might be. It is my hope and prayer that you consider Thistle House as your rightful inheritance. I wish I were able to maintain it as beautifully as it was when you last saw it, underneath the peeling paint and the chipped plaster and wild vines. The cottage is still a grand old friend who longs to welcome you back. I have left Thistle House to Isabel Crofton MacFarlane, because that is the name you go by, and I wish to make it as seamless as possible for you to take possession of it. But should you encounter any difficulty, my attorney has a sealed letter for me, verifying your true identity, that need only be opened if anyone doubts your claim to my property. Please come as soon as you can to claim Thistle House, Emmy. I do not know how many months or even years will have transpired between my writing this and your reading it. The doctor says my heart is giving out,
and I find that I agree. It is my earnest desire to give the heart of my home to you, dear Emmeline. And there is another reason I am hoping you will come back to see Thistle House. I shall not trouble you with the details of this reason, if your wish is to sell the cottage unseen, and be divested of your last tie to the person you were when first I met you. If you come, as I truly hope you will, then you will be able to do what you wish with the letter that is waiting for you in the top drawer of my bedside table. I have prayed every day since you left, 12 years ago, that you would find the courage to forgive yourself for what seemed to you to be unforgivable actions. There was a time, decades ago, when I felt as you do, and I was granted the same courage because my dear husband prayed the same for me. Rose's accident was my fault, Emmy. At least that is how I saw it. I was angry with her the day she went swimming alone. She liked the same boy I liked, and she knew I liked him. Rose was pretty and graceful, and could have had the affection of any boy in our neighborhood. She chose Martin because I liked him. It was a petty sibling rivalry, nothing more. But I let it get the best of me, in every sense of the word. She asked me to come swimming with her the day of her accident, begged me to. It was a sweltering hot day, and there was a lake near their summer place that we went to for holiday every August. I said no, just because I was mad at her. I was 14, she 13. Since I was the older, my parents had always looked to me to watch out for her, a charge I had begun to detest. Rose was clearly the more confident, the more engaging, and the more capable. And we were not little children anymore. Our parents, school teachers on term break, had gone to the city that afternoon to pick up the post, get some groceries, pay bills. They had left me in charge. Rose and I weren't supposed to swim at the lake alone. That had been the rule since we were young. But she went anyway, and told me if she drowned, it would be all my fault. She didn't drown when she hit her head diving into the lake, but to nearly drown can be just as life-changing. And for her, of course, it was. If the two boys who had been fishing had not walked by at just that moment, she would have died. As it was, she lived, but her brain had been deprived of oxygen for too long. She was different when she finally came home to us. And so was I. And while I knew she should not have gone swimming alone, and that what she did was not my fault, I had wanted something bad to happen to her, Emmy. It was this fleeting but ferocious desire for harm to come to her that haunted me for years afterward. She did not remember begging me to come with her. I could not forget that she did. In my more desperate times, I let myself believe God kept me from having children to punish me for what I did to Rose. But in the end, I came to see that we all make choices, Emmy. I made mine, Rose made hers. Our parents decided to leave us alone that day. Those boys decided to go fishing. I am not such a significant creature in God's universe that it is my decisions alone that can change the destiny of another. We make our choices, you and I, in a world that isn't perfect. And while I wish I had made different choices, as I know you do, which one of us can say that if we had, nothing bad would have ever happened to the people we loved? You are not to blame for what happened to Julia, any more than I am to blame for what happened to Rose. I have wanted to tell you this for many years, but I did not want you to think that I see my loss as comparable to yours. I know yours is the greater. It has been a joy to know you and to love you, Emmeline. I am thankful every day that God brought you and Julia into my life. I leave to you the only treasure I have in hope that it will bring you peace. Yours always, Charlotte. I look up from the letter, Isabella staring out the window again, her eyes shimmering with unshed tears. When she speaks, her voice is hushed. Mac was sitting next to me at the kitchen table as I was reading that letter, because it had not occurred to me when I opened it that I would need to hide it from him. He kept saying, "Isabel, what is it? What's wrong?" I knew I could no longer keep the truth from him. I told him everything. It was a very complicated day after that. He was not happy with me. I had not trusted him with the truth about who I was, and that hurt him to his core. We barely spoke to each other for the next few days. Weeks, really. Gwen could see that we'd had an argument, and asked me repeatedly what it was about. I finally told her that a distant aunt had left me a 100-year-old cottage in England, and that we were at odds about what to do with it. She pauses for a moment, and then continues. By May, things were no better between Mac and me. We both decided it might be best if I came to Thistle House for the summer, assessed the future of both it and our marriage. Mac had a manuscript due, so it made sense to our friends and family that I would take Gwen for a 3-month stay in England to check out an inheritance, and that Mac would stay and work on his book. So that was what we did. Gwen and I arrived in June of that year. "But you stayed," I say when she pauses. "Your husband joined you, right?" "Yes, we stayed." "Did you stay because of that other letter Charlotte mentioned? The one in her bedside table?" Isabel tips her head. "Oh, I suppose that had something to do with it. But it's not the primary reason we decided to stay." I wait. "You recall that I told you that once you play your hand, you can't live as though you still hold all the cards?" "Yes," I said. And she hands me the leather-bound notebook in her lap. Part 3. Chapter 34. Julia. June 8, 1958. Dear Emmy, it's been so long since I've imagined you being alive that I don't really know where to begin. My therapist, Dr. Diamon, said that I should pretend that I am writing you a letter. Think of you as alive, and just start writing. It doesn't matter how I start, she said. It only matters that I do. She feels that writing to you like this will allow me to move on with my life, put you to rest, so to speak, so that I will not be haunted by your memory anymore. Actually, Dr. Diamon says you do not haunt me, Emmy. I haunt myself, with everything that is left undone between us. This journal will allow me to say what I need to, she says. It will allow me to move on. I think that's a very strange way of putting it, to move on, as if I were frozen in one place, and therefore I must do something drastic to start moving again. When are we ever able to stop moving? You and I know better than anyone that the earth continues to turn, no matter what happens to you, and it takes you with it whether you want to go or not. You keep breathing, your heart keeps beating, the sun keeps traveling the sky, and the world just keeps spinning. When one day ends, you crawl into bed, and when you wake up, another day is there waiting for you. You really have no choice. If I truly had the power to stop things from moving, I would have exercised it a long time ago. Dr. Diamon is not my first doctor, but she is my favorite. Simon likes her too, and that's good. I think you'd like Simon. He's smart and kind, and reminds me of Neville, except that he's dependable and honest and alive. He has curly brown hair, eyes like chocolate, and he looks like he's in a perpetual state of surprise. I think that's the feature I like best about him. He seems always on the verge of discovering something amazing. He's the one who found Dr. Diamon, actually, There was a long stretch of time when I didn't have a therapist. I guess I thought I had outgrown the need for one. When I finally decided I was ready to move back to London a few years ago, I figured that was proof enough I was done with needing one. It had been 18 years, after all. Good Lord. You'd think I would have a handle on it, wouldn't you? But then I met Simon and fell in love with him, and the very prospect of being deliriously happy for the first time in my life just about drove me crazy. I nearly quit my job and moved back home to Granny's. But Simon, God love him, convinced me to stay. He found Dr. Diamond for me. Simon knows everything that happened to me. Well, pretty much everything. I don't think anyone knows everything. But Simon loves me, despite my being a wreck, and he says he will wait for me to be able to say that I'll marry him. Quite the fellow, right? That's pretty much why he wanted to find someone like Dr. Diamond. He has also had a couple of appointments with Dr. Diamond himself, just so he can know what to say to me. And I guess what not to. Dr. Diamond is probably 40, maybe older, smokes these skinny brown cigarettes, and wears wild prints that make me think of Morocco or Zanzibar. She's not like any of the psychiatrists I had when I was little. The first one was a dreadful pug-faced troll named Dr. Nielsen. He was supposed to have been this brilliant doctor, who knew exactly how to cure a child chained to fear and anxiety. There were times when I wanted to throw that man off a bridge, Emmy. All he ever wanted to talk about was that day. The last day I saw you, over and over and over. That was the last thing I wanted to talk about with him. I didn't want to talk about it with anyone. That was why I stopped talking, for heaven's sake. You know, I look back on it now and I think, what in the world was he doing? Wanting me to relive that day in his office every time I was dragged in to see him. How did he think I got to be the way I was? It was from having to live that day the first time. Granny eventually decided Dr. Nielsen wasn't helping me. She said it was because he was American, and what did we expect? She didn't say this to me. She said it to her fellow expats when she assumed that because I wasn't talking, I wasn't listening. The next doctor was just okay. The third one, Dr. Hunt, I liked very much. But he got married and moved away after only 2 years. I saw him from my 10th birthday to just before my 12th. He had been able to get me to utter a few sentences the last few months we were together, and he told me before he left for Texas that I honestly didn't have to worry about talking and not talking. It wasn't a big deal. When I was ready to resume communicating verbally, I would know it. He had never met a person like me, who didn't start talking again when she was ready. There wasn't a magic formula for it. When I was ready, I would just start talking again. I'll never forget how I felt when he said he had met others like me. I even managed to ask him about it. "Yes," he said, "there are many, many people like me. In fact, everyone is like me. We're all susceptible to loss and the effects of trauma. There isn't a one of us who could experience what I did and not struggle to find some way of coping with it." I was so glad to hear that. I hated feeling like I was different. Weird. That's what kids call you when you don't talk, Emmy. They didn't call me weird to my face, but I knew what they whispered about me. "That's the English girl who doesn't talk, except when she counts things. How come she doesn't talk? The Nazis killed her family and she's not even Jewish. How'd she get away? No one knows. No one will ever know. Why does she count things? Because she's cuckoo." There were a lot of times I wanted to tell stupid kids like that, "The Nazis did not kill my family." But if I had, they might have asked, "Well then, who did?" I didn't have an answer for that. After Dr. Hunt, I didn't want to see another doctor, and I wasn't made to right away. The war ended just a few months later anyway, and Granny wanted to go back to England. I didn't want to come back initially. In fact, the first time I had yelled anything in 5 years was when I told Granny I didn't want to go back to England. She was happy to have me yelling, but after she got over her joy, we had our first argument.
"But it's where your home is, Julia," she said.
"I don't have a home," I yelled.
"Your home is with me."
"I don't have a home."
"Your home, Julia, is with me. I'm your family, me and Gramps."
In the end, we went back. Of course we went back. We're not Americans. Granny and Gramps have a nice house in Woodstock near Oxford, where Gramps, whom I had seen only twice in 5 years, taught literature. He had missed us. He wanted us to come home. As we packed our things to leave Connecticut, I flat out refused to go anywhere near London. Granny said there would be no reason to. It was a wreck anyway. "Ever," I said. And she said if I never wanted to see London again, I didn't have to. We sailed on a ship as big as a city, or so it seemed to me. And when we docked in Southampton, Gramps was there to meet us with his car. He asked me how the crossing was. I told him it was fine compared to our departure, when the U-boats were trying to bomb us. He started to tear up when I said this. And I worried that Granny hadn't told him how scary our first crossing had been. That wasn't it. He knew how terrible it was. He just had never heard my voice before. I actually didn't like the way my voice sounded when I started to talk again. I had been going to school with American kids, and hearing them talk, and even though I hadn't been doing much talking myself, their funny way of speaking had slithered into my head and mixed itself in with the way I'd talked 5 years before. What came out of my mouth when I started communicating verbally again was a weird half-British, half-American mush that made me sound like a psycho.
"It does not make you sound like a psycho,"
Granny had said.
"Where did you hear that word?"
"I sound strange." "You just sound like all the other British children who were evacuated to America, Julia. That's what happens when you're immersed in another culture."
"You don't sound like them," I said.
"That's because I am 50 years older than you.
You are young. It will come back, Julia. The way you talked before will come back."
And I guess it did, mostly. Granny was so happy to be back in England, in her pretty house, and with Gramps, and all the friends she left behind when she evacuated with me to Connecticut. And I guess I liked the house, too. "You would like it, Em. There's a big garden in the back, and rows of raspberry bushes." I had my own room, the one that had been my father's. Granny still had a few of his toys in there, and loads of pictures of him from when he was a baby, and a schoolboy, and when he started to do plays. It made Granny sad to talk about Neville, but she did it anyway. I think she has always been afraid that I would forget him, because I was so young when he left Mum. But there are things you don't forget, even if you are young. She doesn't know I only ever called him Neville. Even all these years later, she doesn't know. She thinks I called him Daddy. "Do you know why I called him Neville?" "Because you did. I was afraid if I started calling him Daddy, then you would call him Daddy. And I didn't want to share him with you, Emmy." "I would now, of course. I would share anything I have with you. Julia." June 11th, 1958. "Dear Emmy, today Simon and I tried to find the street where you and I and Mum lived in Whitechapel. It all looks so different now. I couldn't find it. I can't remember what the actual street was named, and nothing looks familiar. Nothing at all. I know we lived close to St. Paul's, and that we were also near a tube station. But even though we walked down street after street, I couldn't find it. Part of me was relieved, because I'm not completely sure I'm ready to see our flat again. And part of me was annoyed, because what if seeing it would have brought me one step closer to being at peace with everything, you know? Simon had done some checking, and he knew the area east of St. Paul's had been heavily bombed, not just the day I last saw you, but many other times after that. He said it might be that I couldn't find our flat, because it had been destroyed, and something new had been built in its place.